I think is a little counterintuitive to people because they think, oh, I could have this beverage that is sweetened with, something that has no calories. But when you look at the research, they end up eating more calories over the course of a day than they would have if they had just had a regular can of soda.
Hi everyone, it's Dr. Sanjeev Goyal here today, and today I have a very special guest, Dr. Nicole Avena. Dr. Nicole Avena is an associate professor of neuroscience at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York City and a visiting professor of health psychology at Princeton University. She is a research scientist and expert in the fields of nutrition, and she's done groundbreaking work developing models to characterize food addiction and the dangers of excess sugar intake. In addition to over 100 peer-reviewed scholarly publications, Dr. Avena has written several popular books, including her latest book, Sugarless, which covers the latest science on sugar addiction and how to overcome it. She frequently appears as a science expert in the media, including regular appearances on Good Day New York, The Doctors, and the former Dr. Oz show. She has the number two most watched TED-Ed health talk, How Sugar Affects Your Brain, with over 17 million views and counting. You can find her on social media at Dr. Nicole Avena, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. I hope you enjoyed today's talk, and we'll see you on the other side. Hi, Nicole. Thank you so much for joining me today. And
thanks.
Yeah, I know we met about 7 years ago in Toronto at a conference. That time you were telling me about your interest in bringing to light the sugar problem with nutrition for children primarily. So a lot has, I guess, changed since then. If you want to just kind of bring me up to date of what's been happening with you.
Yeah, so a lot certainly changed in those years. Back when we initially met, I was working at that point in my career on looking at the effects that added sugar could have on the health of children and also on the effects during pregnancy. But before that, and since then, I've continued to focus on looking at the effects that sugar really has on our brain and just brain health in general. And so one of the big things that I've been working on lately has been really this idea of sugar and highly processed foods being addictive substances and helping people to understand what that looks like from the neuroscience standpoint and the psychology standpoint, and really how to just navigate in a world that has so much added sugar when we know it's so bad for our health, but we're in many cases often addicted to it.
Mm-hmm. So maybe just for our viewers, let's give us like a Coles Note version of what are sugars, and because we obviously understand what, table sugar is, but sugar is, I guess, found in many different ways and people may not be aware. And yeah, it's not just glucose and maybe other versions of sugar, right?
Right. No. It's sugar is a funny word because it means so many different things. And so when I talk about the dangers of sugar, I'm really talking about the dangers of added sugar. And so these are the types of sugars that get added to our food, either by us or by the food industry. And so the things you've heard of, sucrose, high fructose corn syrup, fruit juice concentrate, agave nectar, like all of those things, there's probably over 200 different types of added sugars that could end up in our food supply. The list is almost endless. And so those sugars are really not needed for our health. And what we're finding is that people are consuming them in excess, and that's leading to a variety of different health complications and mental health complications as well. But sugar in general, when we hear about the term sugar, we have to keep in mind, well, sugar is something that our body will make for us. Our body will, we need glucose as a fuel. Glucose is a type of sugar. And so our body will make glucose for us. Even if we didn't eat any added sugar, our body will find a way to make it for us. And so one of the things that
where would they be making the sugar from? I mean, I understand we could be making from proteins, one could make sugar, and from fats as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, so there's a process called gluconeogenesis. And basically, this is how all the people who are doing like a really strict keto diet, or not eating any carbohydrates or very small amounts, are able to still fuel their brain and fuel their body with glucose, because your body is able to basically utilize other things to then convert it into glucose. So one other thing about defining sugar that I think is important to bring up is sugar is also found in fruit. It's also found in a variety of things that come naturally packaged from nature. And so I don't really think that the fruit sugar is necessarily the problem in the sense that people aren't becoming obese because they're eating too many apples. It's really the fact that they're having too much sugar sweetened beverages like fruit juices, or they're having too much of this processed food. That's really what's contributing more so to the problems we're seeing with overweight and obesity these days.
Yeah, because I actually think this is actually very interesting, because I was mentioning I'm talking to my parents yesterday. And the first thing they said to me is, look, we're eating, wasn't this fruit healthy? They had put a couple of blueberries aside and they said, look, this has to be healthy. How can this be not healthy? I said, well, I told them, okay, it must be for eating in excess of the amount of calories that we could burn, then that sugar would probably move to fat stores. And I've heard a couple other speakers, I believe Dr. Johnson talks about the dangers of fructose. There are people who talk about this fructose is causing fatty liver or has more likely to be deposited as fat.
Right. The thing about that, and again, I think that your parents are right in eating fruit is probably very good for them because it's got antioxidants, it's got fiber, it's really packaged in a way that, yes, it contains sugar, but it's also containing a lot of other things that are going to support our health. I think the place where people get in trouble with fruit is if they're using juice or if they're making smoothies and basically having so much liquid sugar or liquid to fruit, in the sense that you can put 8 apples into a blender and make an apple smoothie, right? And probably drink it and be fine. But if I told you to sit there and sit down and eat 8 apples, you probably wouldn't be able to do it because it's a lot. And so I think that my advice for people is try to eat your fruit and definitely don't juice it. You want to try to make sure you're eating it whole.
That's a very interesting point too, that because there's a lot of what we call diets out there or just health practices where people are juicing, and lots of businesses are built on that as well. I suspect that by processing that those fruits, that the glycemic response is going up much faster. And it makes sense when something is not a very sweet fruit juice, but I think if sweet fruit juice would probably be as bad as a sugary drink.
Absolutely. And I think there's a place for juicing of vegetables, and there is a place for adding some fruit juice, maybe if you're having a kale drink and you have to add a little something to it, maybe to just take away the bitterness, that's fine. But I think the problem I have with a lot of the juice business, and you can see this if you go into any store or at the grocery store, most of the juices are largely fruit, and there's dominant of fruit as opposed to vegetables. And so I think that, again, you have to keep in mind, you're getting rid of the fiber, you're getting rid of a lot of the nutrients, and you're really just retaining minimal amounts of nutrients and the sugar. And that's something that we're really not interested in hanging on to.
I know we're going to talk a little bit about what should people be doing, but maybe just since we're talking about fruit juices and things like that, like how many grams of carbs would you think it seems, would they say, okay, this is like a lot that should they should, versus for one serving, versus this is an okay amount? Like, what are some type of guidelines one could think about when they're looking at a drink like that?
Yeah, I think it's really about looking not so much at the total carbs, but so much like the added sugar. And so a lot of the smoothie industry and the juicing industry, you do have to be mindful, it can involve them adding additional sugar. And so in the US, we have guidelines that suggest people should have no more than 6 to 8 teaspoons of sugar each day. And to be honest, the average American is having probably more like 22 teaspoons of added sugar each day. And a lot of it is because it's undetected. It's hidden in so many foods. People just don't even realize that they're consuming products that have all these added sugars. So I really say go as low as possible and really not so much looking at the carbs, because you could have something that has 20 grams of carbohydrates, but if the majority of that is fiber, then that's good. It might not have any added sugar. And so I think a better number to focus on is that added sugar and just try to get it as low as possible.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So we talked a little bit about processed foods. What we obviously have had sugar in our diets some amount for, you know, thousands of years, I suspect. But what has changed? What has changed in the last 100 years or so with the amount of sugars that are coming in?
Yeah, I think that what's really changed is that we've been able to revolutionize the food industry, and we've been able to mass produce quantities of food that allow us to feed a lot of people for fairly little money. And so when we take a look at our food environment now compared to 100 years ago, 100 years ago, it was dominated by fresh foods, things that would, you know, go stale in a couple of days. You had to do your grocery shopping a few times a week. Whereas now, most of the products in the grocery store are processed foods that are shelf stable. And so when we do that, it comes at a cost. And I think a lot of that has been the fact that we have all of these engineered foods. I don't even know if I want to call them food, because they're combinations of ingredients that are put together to make them taste good, to make them last on a shelf for a long time, and to be attractive to the consumer. They're going to smell a certain way. They're going to melt in your mouth a certain way. And I think that as a result, we've become accustomed to eating those types of foods. We've gotten dependent on the convenience of those foods, and we end up overeating them. And we know that they affect the brain in a way that can promote addiction. And that's part of the reason why we overeat them. So I think it's just simply the fact that we've completely changed what we're eating. And as a result, it's affecting our health. And it took a couple of years, I think, for it to catch up with us in terms of the fact that by eating all these processed foods, it's going to have health impacts.
Okay. So maybe let's talk now about the effect of food on those reward pathways, dopamine pathways. Maybe you could just take us through what happens normally in the brain and what's happening when we're having these sugary foods. What's different?
Well, this is something that we've spent a lot of time studying in my lab. And so when you normally eat a food, you have a response in your brain. And typically, if it's the very first time you've ever had that food, you're going to want to pay attention, because when we taste something that's new, we have this evolutionary instinct to be aware of what's going on. Because if you think about it, like our hunter and gatherer ancestors, if they ate something that tasted funny or wasn't recognizable, they'd want to pay attention, because if it's poisonous, you could be dead. And so normally when we have a new cuisine, we'll pay attention and we'll our brain will release dopamine in the reward areas of the brain, not so much because it's pleasurable, but because we need to be on high alert, right? In case this thing isn't good for us. But typically after you've had something a few times and tasted it, that response goes away. And so normally when you eat food, it doesn't release dopamine in response to eating it in these regions of the brain. But what's interesting about sugar is that it's very different. Drugs of abuse are addictive because of the fact that they can release dopamine every single time they're administered. That's the hallmark of drug use. You use heroin, morphine, nicotine, it releases dopamine in these regions of the brain. And what we see with sugar is that it acts like a drug, in the sense that when sugar is administered, dopamine is released every single time. And so that's unique, and it makes it very different than what we typically expect to see with food. And 100 years ago, maybe that would have been fine, because we only had sugar very rarely. We didn't have it all day, every day. Whereas now we're in a very different situation, where we're constantly releasing dopamine every single time we pretty much eat everything, because of the fact that it contains added sugar.
So does the effect of having repeated exposure to this sugar cause a change in the reward pathways?
Absolutely. So it is that repeated exposure. And we've done experiments on this in the lab, where if we have conditions where it is just an exposure, maybe on the first day and the 30th day or a couple times here and there, we don't see that dopamine response. But when we have that repeated exposure, that seems to be what's driving these addiction-like changes in the brain and this effect on the dopamine system. Mm-hmm. And I think for most people, they think, oh, well, I only have sugar once in a while, or oh, I just have dessert at night. But it's not just the sweets that we know about. It's in the morning, if you're having a yogurt, for example, if it has fruit in it and the fruit wasn't put there by you, it came in the bottle of yogurt or the little container of yogurt, odds are that it's got a lot of added sugar in it as well. And even foods that we don't expect to have added sugar often have sugar as a preservative marker, because what ends up happening is things like breads and other items that are going to spoil, they can add chemicals to them and different ingredients to help them be preserved, but those ingredients often have a taste. And so if you add sugar, that can help mask those off-putting tastes that are added to many processed foods. So again, it's not just about having sugar once in a while. We end up having it pretty much throughout the day and often don't even realize it.
So what happens if there's repeated sugar exposure? Does that lead to like a reduced peak of pleasurable experience from the dopamine?
Yes, that's exactly what happens. And so it's very similar to what happens with drugs and alcohol. People can develop tolerance. And by tolerance, I mean that you need to consume more and more of a substance in order to feel the euphoria that you used to get from having less of it. And that is because just having one cookie isn't going to release as much dopamine this time. You actually need to have two in order to feel satisfaction. And then you have to have three and four. And so this is where people can start to develop not only tolerance in the sense where they feel like they need more, but they can also develop binging behavior, because consuming a large amount in a small amount of time often becomes the way in which people can facilitate that dopamine response.
Okay, so that might be a way of identifying if you have a sugar addiction. You'd be having binging kind of episodes or symptoms. Is that correct?
Yes, typically people who identify as having a sugar addiction will say that they binge on sugar, that they find that their cravings are so powerful that they end up restraining themselves to a certain point, and then they end up giving in and having a binge. And this vicious spiral can emerge where they're binging, then they go into withdrawal, and then they're craving, and it just seems to go on from there.
And so is sugar addiction, do you think, related to binge eating disorder or bulimia?
I do think it is. There's been some studies that have looked at food addiction and binge eating disorder and the relationship between the two. And it doesn't necessarily appear that they're synonymous, meaning that food addiction isn't just another term for binge eating disorder. But there does seem to be overlaps in terms of the fact that people who have binge eating disorder can also have a comorbid food addiction and vice versa.
Okay. And what about with any other psychiatric disorders? Is there any type of connection between sugar addiction?
Yeah. So in my new book, Sugarless, I talk about the mental health piece, because I think we often overly focus on the physical health part of this, right? Because we'll talk about how sugar is linked to diabetes and obesity and heart disease. But I think that the mental health piece is really important. And we're learning a lot about how sugar can have an impact on our mood. It can have an impact on our behavior, right? And so certainly there does seem to be a link between sugar and mood, I would say, is probably the most research supported area of overlap. I also think that when we take a look at the research, we see that people will actually often use sugar to self-medicate their mood disorders, their anxiety, their feelings of depression, and that kind of thing. And so it's not uncommon for people, when they reflect on the reasons why they're binging on sugar or why they feel stressed or triggered to then have a craving, it can often be linked to something that is associated with promoting anxiety or just affecting their mood in a negative way.
It sounds to me sometimes it's a vicious cycle where people will have a binge, let's say, to self-medicate, but then feel like a sense of guilt about eating, or because they know that's not something they wanted to do. They're trying to lose weight, or they just didn't like that they binged on a bag of popcorn or whatever it is. So I'm just wondering that, yeah, have you seen that type? It's kind of like a vicious cycle. What do you think on that, about that?
Yes, I use that term quite a bit to describe it, because it really is a vicious cycle. It is a cycle of guilt and shame and needing some way in which you can moderate your emotions and feelings, and then ultimately turning toward food to try to ameliorate whatever the issues are. And it's a temporary feeling of satisfaction, but then it's very quickly followed by, again, these, you know, feelings of distress and guilt and shame and anxiety all over again. So I think that when people become mindful of the fact that they are often using food as a way to self-soothe and to self-medicate, that it can be useful because it can help people to pause before they go into eating something and really reflect on why they're doing it, and then decide if maybe there's a different way in which they can moderate their anxiety or they can cope with whatever stressor they're facing aside from using food to try to manage those emotions.
So what's happening in, let's go through some of the other terms. So we talked about addiction. Maybe let's talk about tolerance. What is tolerance? If you could just explain that to our viewers.
Yeah, so tolerance is, again, it's one of the symptoms that's associated with substance use disorder. It's when you need to take more and more of the substance to feel euphoria that you used to only get from a little bit. And so we see tolerance happening often with sugar. And it's interesting because it's something that we see happening with children, especially. Children just naturally have a higher threshold for sweetness. So kids will find stuff to be the preferred level of sweetness at a higher amount than adults do. And just over time, our preference slowly swings down. But we'll see these days, kids will have a sweet preference that is almost off the charts.
Yeah, out of control, exactly. Because I remember things I find that were sweet now, I can't handle anymore. I think you're right. As people get older, their taste buds change or something happens. But you're right, children are, they can handle those sweet things much easier.
Yeah, and even my own kids, like the stuff that they find to be sweet, especially my younger one who's 8 years old, I find it almost aversive. Like I wouldn't, it's too sweet where it's not even enjoyable. But again, they live in different sensory worlds than us. That's just the way that their brains and their makeup is designed. But again, it's a danger though, because they naturally prefer things to be really sweet. And our food environment is designed where it already is really sweet. And so when kids are developing tolerance and need to have more and more, you can imagine the amounts of sugar that most kids are then consuming in order to feel like they're getting pleasure from whatever those.
And then the next word is, I guess, withdrawal. So what's happening with, I guess, in animals and in humans when they're withdrawing from sugar? So for example, I've seen my kids tend to get anxious or, you know, agitated after we've given them a birthday cake slice or something. But what's happening there?
Yeah, so the withdrawal piece is interesting. It's similar to the tolerance in that it's this physical evidence of dependence. And it's one of the criteria used to diagnose someone as having a substance use disorder. And with sugar, it can look what happens when someone's dependent on nicotine. And so if somebody has been eating sugar in excessive amounts for quite some time, and then they abruptly stop and really cut it down, they'll, in some cases, experience things like irritability, crankiness, lethargy, just kind of feeling like tired and in a bad mood. And a lot of times, believe it or not, people have said to me, oh, I think my blood sugar was dropping because I got like really tired and crabby, and so I ended up eating some sugar because my blood sugar was dropping. And then I'll tell them, well, no, you were actually in withdrawal. That's what withdrawal feels like. Your blood sugar is fine. It's the withdrawal. And it's the way in which your brain is now trying to adapt to not constantly being stimulated by these surges of dopamine that it was used to getting day in and day out. And so it's interesting. The withdrawal piece, I think, is scary to a lot of people because nobody wants to feel bad, right? That's why you use sugar to feel good. But it's different for everybody. And some people say that it's mild and it's not so bad, but other people have a harder time with it. And that's often the reason why they end up going back to sugar and going back to their old habits.
And so what's it? And so cravings, I guess, is the next, or related. It's related to withdrawal, I assume, but it's not exactly the same thing. What's cravings is the feeling to kind of take that substance back in, right? Is that correct?
Right. So cravings are interesting because it's normal for us to have food cravings. We're designed to crave certain types of foods or classes of foods. In some cases, it's because it's our body's way of signaling that we need something. And so, for example, if let's just say your blood sugar or your blood pressure, let's say, was maybe getting a little bit low, you might crave something salty that would contribute to regulating your blood levels.
Right.
Or if you are suddenly craving a hamburger, it could be because maybe your iron levels are a little bit low and your body has the memory of knowing that when you eat hamburgers, it provides you with sources of iron. So we unconsciously know all of this. This is all kind of happening in the background in terms of how we're able to have these cravings. But I think that the bigger issue we see these days isn't those types of cravings. It's what are known as hedonic cravings. And so hedonic cravings are cravings for pleasure that you get from food. They have nothing to do with calorie needs or regulating your vitamin levels or nutrient needs. It's all about the pleasure. And so this is why when people eat an entire meal, and then if you're at a restaurant and the server comes over and says, oh, who would like dessert? People often are able to find room for dessert. And again, it's not necessarily because they need or want the calories, they want the pleasure. And that's what's happening a lot when it comes to sugar addiction, is that people will get these very powerful cravings for sugar. And it's because they desire that pleasure that they have a history of getting from it.
Okay. And so when one has, what type of advice can you give to people to, when they have that type of craving happening and they're just aware of it, what can they do about that?
Well, the best thing to do is to wait it out. And I know that can sound torturous and be very difficult for people, but the longer the distance and time you put between the craving and actually giving into the craving, the weaker over time that association will be. And so it's simple learning. It's a stimulus and the response, right? And if you have a stimulus and then wait a while and then have the response isn't really tightly linked to that stimulus anymore because other stuff happened in between. And so the same thing goes with having cravings. If you have a craving for something, the best thing you can do is try to distract yourself. I mean, I'm not an advocate for people playing on their phones all day, but I will say for people who are really trying to avoid cravings, they can be a benefit because if you can just say, oh, I have a craving for something that I just smelled down the hall, somebody brought donuts into work, I'm going to go get one. If you could distract yourself just long enough, it'll pass because these cravings, again, they come in waves and then they come and they are less intense. So it's really about just making time.
Biochemically, what's happening in your craving? What's being released? Is that what, yeah, what's the molecule that's doing that?
So it's, again, it comes back to the dopamine. And so we have that memory of eating that food and it providing us with the pleasure, which just the thought of that can prime that dopamine response.
Okay.
And so it's similar to the
anticipation.
And advertisement.
Yeah, I guess it's anticipation or something. I mean, dopamine's being released in advance even before the reward comes. Is that what's happening?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it's being released in anticipation of the reward. It's almost like a little bit of dopamine just spills out of the cells. And that's enough to really just tease the neurons in the way that's going to then say, oh, come on, let's go get more. Give us the real stuff. We want to have a real dopamine release here. And it's really powerful. Okay. And it's for many people, it's really one of the things that is difficult for them to get a handle on. But in my book, I try to help people understand what these cravings are, and then again, ways to distract yourself or to minimize their effects so that over time, they won't be as intense.
Okay, and we have to talk about sugar substitutes. I know I was reading your book about that, but I'd love if you could just take us through. I have some questions, just things that some people generally think it's a good idea to have a Coke Zero or versus having a Coke. And I'd love to just tell people, what's the research on these type of sugar substitutes? Do they actually help with weight loss? And where are they beneficial if they are?
Yeah, I think that unfortunately, we are at the point now with the research where it doesn't look like the sugar substitutes are doing all that we had initially hoped they would when they first all came about. When we talk about the effects on addiction, it's not so much sugar, but it's the sweet taste of sugar that's driving this addiction-like response. And so even if you use an artificial sweetener or something that has zero calories as a sweetener, it's not going to help with the addiction. It's really almost kind of like a band-aid, if you will. It's still going to be promoting the cravings and the withdrawal and those types of things. So if you're looking to break your addiction to sugar, it's really in your best interest to minimize our dependence on all of the different sweeteners that are out there, even if they have zero calories.
So the brain can't differentiate between, let's say, a stevia sweetener or erythritol versus table sugar? Is the brain thinking these are the exact same thing?
Well, you know what's interesting? The brain thinks it's the same reward, right? It releases dopamine because it tastes good, it's sweet, it has this sweetness to it. But in many ways, it's messing up other parts of the brain, right? Because if we're not getting the calories from these sugars, then the satiety signaling functions of our brain, normally when you taste sugar, you're expecting that there's calories involved.
Right.
But if there's no calories, then that satiety part of your brain is going to say, oh, okay, well, I didn't get calories anymore when I taste something sweet, so I'm just going to be hungry all the time. And so we're basically messing up the calibration in our brains to detect whether or not we are hungry or whether or not we feel full. And it's just one of those things that I think is a little counterintuitive to people because they think, oh, I could have this beverage that is sweetened with, you know, something that has no calories. How could that be bad for me? I can have the sweetness and then I don't have any calories. But when you look at the research, it's actually showing, especially in people who are struggling with obesity, they end up eating more calories over the course of a day than they would have if they had just had a regular can of soda with actual sugar in it and actual calories in it.
So how much percent of that, how much, what are we talking about? Like 10% more? What type of difference is that? That's a pretty remarkable fact if we're actually taking more calories in.
Yeah. I don't recall from that study off the top of my head exactly how many more calories, but you know, even if it's a smaller amount, it adds up. And if you're doing this every day, that's over the course of months in a year. I mean, you could talk about a significant number of pounds of body weight that people are retaining or putting back on. So my advice with the artificial sweeteners is that, again, they could be a crutch, I think, psychologically for some people who really are compelled to eat added sugar and put it on everything so that they don't feel like they're depriving themselves. But I think at the end of the day, you want to work to reduce your dependence on those too, and really just try to reduce the fact that we have to have everything in our diet sweetened all the time.
And so how long would it take for somebody to kind of see a change? Let's say they're starting to reduce their sugar intake, they're starting to eat less sweet foods. How long will the pain last? Like before they start to see, hey, this is not as hard as it used to be.
Honestly, it's the approach that I suggest in my book, Sugarless. It's a stepwise approach. It's not meant to be this cold turkey overnight approach because that doesn't work. There's already been a ton of things in the diet culture that have promoted this whole black or white thinking about you can eat this, you can't eat that. I advocate people really just start to phase it out and replace it with alternatives that are still going to allow them to feel satisfied, but they're going to have just less added sugar and less reliance on sweetness. And so I think that in terms of when do you start to feel better, I think it's almost immediately, to be honest, because you get control over what you're doing. I think for me, a lot of people struggle with their diet because they don't have a plan. Like they know they're supposed to follow a eating guide or they're supposed to follow, here's the list of foods you can eat and can't eat. But it's difficult to stick to something like that because again, the cravings and the compulsions and the habits and all these other psychological things that happen that make it so that we can't just follow this list of foods to eat and list of foods to avoid. So I think that when you get the control and realize, okay, I have a plan, I'm trying to reduce, it doesn't have to be perfect. I'm allowed to have a cookie if I really want one. It's not the end of the day. It doesn't mean I messed up. I think that forgiveness allows people to get some sense of control and know that they're still on the right path. And I think the withdrawal piece of it, most people say it's a couple of days that they feel like a little cranky and it gets easier as time goes on. And from there, I think it just only gets better, especially when people start to feel their energy level come back and they start to feel they have more clarity of thought. They feel like their mood is improving. It's just a lot of benefits that people often just don't even realize they were struggling with will come about when they start to really reduce their sugar.
Okay, yeah. And do you mind sharing a little bit of any, is there some of your personal story? Like how, I mean, you're an expert. So obviously on yourself, you must have gone through this journey. So I'd love to just hear like, how has that been, you know, and with your children as well? Because that's, I'd love to give people advice. Like, how do you actually deal with this in real life? Like, how do you actually?
Yeah, I mean, I personally, I've not had any personal struggles with sugar. To be honest, I grew up in a house where my parents, I was a kid in the 1980s, and so people didn't really know much about, or know as much as they should have, at least, about processed foods and sodas and things like that. And I always grew up with that stuff around. And I don't know why, for some reason, I just kind of got turned off by it, I think, as I got older. And so when I went to college, and then more so when I went to graduate school, I started studying how food affects the brain. And that really changed my perception of a lot of things. But again, I live in the real world. I have little kids and I get it that they want sugar, they want candy, they want to go trick or treating, they want to have a birthday party with cupcakes and all that. And so what I've found to be most beneficial, and I've had a lot of people agree with me on this, is it's really about teaching our kids, not that you can't have this, but that you need to understand how much of it you're having and know when to put the brakes on and know when to police yourself. So if my daughter comes home and says, oh, it was Susie's birthday today and we had cupcakes that her mother brought in, she'll have a cupcake, but then she knows not to ask for dessert because she already had dessert at school. And so I think it's just helping kids create healthy boundaries and but doing it in a way that it's to promote their health. I mean, I never talk about body weight with my kids. It's not about, oh, if you eat this, you'll get heavy or anything like that. It's all about, well, you got to be healthy so you have energy to run up and down the basketball court and you have energy to play with your friends and you got to stay healthy so you can go to school because if you eat too much sugar, it compromises your immune system and you'll be more likely to catch a cold and then you can't go to school. So I really try to put the health spin on it and I think that works. And it does then, I think, encourage the kids to want to adopt that mindset around sugar.
That makes total sense. Okay, so maybe just closing it off here, what we're all kind of addicted to sugar, and I think a lot of people are going to feel a little overwhelmed with hearing this, hearing our talk today. What would be the first step they should do to just beginning on this journey? I think this journey from personal experience probably takes years to make this kind of change and be okay with it. So it's a long road, but maybe if you could just kind of give us, what does that first step look like?
Yeah, well, I think it is a long road, but so what? Our life is a long road, right? Hopefully we're going to live a long road. And I think that, you know, you have to keep in mind, you want this to be a journey, right? Because you want to keep doing it. You don't want to just, anybody can eat a certain way for 30 days or 60 days and then stop and go back to their old ways. That's not the goal. The goal is to change your relationship with food, change the way you think about what you put in your body. And so it really is about baby steps. And in the book, I really outline well how you can do that and why these baby steps are important and why making these small changes over time end up amounting to very large changes, but you don't realize it. And so when you change things slowly but surely, yes, it seems like it takes longer for the results to appear, but the results are going to stay. And I think that's ultimately what we want. That's where our diet culture has pretty much destroyed us because we have all these diet programs that make all these promises and then none of them ever work and nothing sticks. And I think that's where we have to start to think about wanting to make changes.
Well, okay. Thank you. This is really great. We may need a part two. And for our viewers out there, the book is called Sugarless. And where is it? Where can they find it?
Yeah, so it's Sugarless is available wherever books are sold. You can find it on Amazon. It's also on Barnes and Nobles. And you can find it on my website, drnicoleavina.com. And it's a great read for anybody who's interested in understanding the role that sugar has on their health and what they can do to minimize it.
I downloaded it on my iBooks and Apple platform. It was great
great read so far, so I really do recommend it. Thanks so much. I really appreciate your time today, and we may check in again in a year and see how things are moving. What's your feeling about the whole people's awareness of the impact of sugar on health? Like, where is that going? Obviously, things have changed in the last 7 years since we've met, but you know, how far have we come? You know, how much more we have to go?
Yeah, I think it's starting to change. I think there are more people listening. I'm a professor at Princeton. I just taught my health psychology class that just started for the spring term. And I can say, even among younger people, I'm encouraged by the interest in understanding how sugar affects our health. But I still think we have a ways to go. I think there's a lot of work to do, and we really need to work on figuring out our food environment and how we can hopefully adapt that in a way that will allow us to still enjoy foods and have the things that we want, but work on getting them lower in added sugar, because I think that's really the biggest challenge we have right now.
Perfect. All right. We'll talk to you soon then. Thank you again. Really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks.
Hi, I hope you enjoyed today's talk with Dr. Nicole Lavina. The link to her book, Sugarless, is in the description, as well as ways that you can contact her. Please, if you enjoyed today's talk, like and subscribe. It really makes a big difference to make sure this message gets out to more people. We'll see you next time.